With me is James Lowe, who we think of as related to Scotland or England or the United States, but you're clearly in France right now, aren't you?
We are, yeah. We're just having a little holiday. I think with the weather outside, it's nice to maybe imagine ourselves somewhere in the south of France in the summer at the moment.
Perfect. Well, let's this fascinating concert, and in a little bit we'll spend time with Alan Vizzuti and the Tomasi Concerto, but Dravel, as they say, Debussy, Ravel, they're lumped together just because they were the two great composers, more or less simultaneously living. And so we do lump them together, and you have a Debussy piece and a Ravel piece. Talk a little bit about what's not lumped together about them, about the unique aspects of those two amazing composers.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. For me, when you look at a score of Ravel, it's very different from listening to it, because when you listen to it, you get this huge kind of romantic wash of sound. When you actually look at the score, it's done with pinpoint precision. I don't know any other composer that writes such fastidious kind of orchestrations. The way he treats it, the ideas that he has, the colors that he finds, they're so precise. But yet, when you listen to it as a listener, it kind of comes out as this beautiful, rich wash. Debussy, on the other hand, when you look at the scores, it looks kind of vague on paper somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think that their approach to this kind of impressionistic word, which I think is a word that they both actually really hated, this idea of impressionism, mm-hmm. but this idea of somehow nailing down these numinous, like, you know, how do you get the sound of a cloud in an orchestra? Mm. It's incredible. But their approach, I think, is quite different to the same ends.
And you'll get to illuminate both with two halves of the concert. So talk about the Debussy that opens the concert.
Well, it's a wonderful work. It's the Nocturnes, mm. and it's a piece in three parts. The first one is Nuage, Clouds, then Fête or Festivities, and then Sirens. And not sirens like, you know, on the top of the ambulance, mm. but the female voices that sing this sensuous song that lures mm. sailors into unfortunate situations. And he uses the orchestra in this incredibly, incredible way. Like I say, it's about somehow he manages to get concrete, really shifting things, like you feel uncertain, and yet it's all down on paper. And there's this beautiful moment in the last movement when all of a sudden he brings in these 16 female voices and uses them like another instrument in the orchestra. It's some of the most ravishing music ever written.
And that's nice. And then the voices get to stay around for the Ravel that you're doing too. Now, Daphnis and Chloe, there's this oh-so-famous suite number two, but you're doing both suites, aren't you?
We are, yes. Yeah. So suite number one is very rarely performed. I've certainly never done it before. Mm. And mostly it's because, you know, you can play the second suite without a chorale. Ravel made it so that you could do that. So it's become a huge kind of tour de force for any orchestra. Mm. But the first suite, you really need a chorale. There's a huge section where it's just the chorale a cappella singing this very complicated and atmospheric music that it sounds gorgeous, but it's really hard to sing. So I think there's a lot of people think, I think, that the first suite is kind of a tricky thing to mount, because you need a really good chorale and a big orchestra. So most people just do the second suite. Yeah. So I'm really happy that we can do both. One day I'd love to do the whole thing. The whole ballet lasts over an hour. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't quite cram that into one half for this one. But at some point in the future, a few years down the line, it's such gorgeous music.
And is this Bouquin Symphony Chorale handling it?
Yeah, very well. We have worked really hard. I've been in now. We've had a few rehearsals together. We had with the orchestra last night, and they're doing a great job.
Yeah. Nice. And the sense of also the drama or not of Daphnis and Chloe is, I mean, first, I think it's kind of cool that by adding the first suite, you kind of get more of the story told. And yet we think of this piece just as a bunch of sensual things. I mean, should we listen with our head or our heart?
Oh, you should definitely listen with your heart. I mean, I think so the first suite, the big spoiler of the first suite is the pirates turn up. So the story is essentially, I mean, like a lot of ballet kind of stories, the story is, something upon which to hang some dancing. But the story is based on this ancient Greek novel, very, very, very early novel, that was considered really racy for most of its history. And it's essentially a shepherd and shepherdess who fall in love but don't really understand what that is. They don't know what that means. They just have these weird feelings they don't understand. She gets kidnapped by pirates, and the god Pan scares the pirates into pandemonium, and eventually she comes back and they're reunited, and then it ends with this huge bacchanal drunken dance, which is really wild. So I don't know. I mean, it for me, I definitely think it's an emotional piece. It has so much range from this kind of really intimate and beautiful. There's an amazing flute solo, which is supposed to be the god Pan playing to his lover Syrinx, you know, who was turned into panpipes in ancient Greek mythology. And then you have this kind of riotous party at the end. I mean, I think it's pretty much got everything in there.
That's Deafness and Chloe. Sweets number one and two, as you say, the thing. If you were to do the ballet sometime, is it ever done as a concert piece, the whole ballet? Do you?
Yeah, generally speaking, there are quite a few performances of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I think it's rarely performed as a ballet nowadays because, mm-hmm. I mean, you've got a huge orchestra and a huge choir, and you know you have to somehow fit them all together, and you've got a load of extra instruments that in the ballet are mm-hmm. off stage behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and it's a logistical nightmare actually to put it on as a whole ballet. So I think it's now relatively rarely performed as a ballet with the full orchestra.
And as you say, a huge orchestra with a lot of extra instruments. Probably all the additional wind instruments and things. Talk a little bit about the scoring.
Yeah, so there's, I think the French composers were obviously obsessed with wind instruments, and mm-hmm. I think they more than any other kind of school of composition really explored what wind instruments can do, and particularly the flute. And I think they loved the flute because it has such an incredible range of colours. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, there's this wonderful flute solo which Bruce Bodden, our fantastic principal, is playing beautifully. But there's also this wonderful bit where you have four flutes, including an alto flute, and there's a big part for the alto flute as well. And just the colours and the range of sounds that he gets out of the orchestra, I think. I'm hard pushed to think of another composer that has that range of colour.
So those are the two famous pieces. And then there's a trumpet concerto, if we can see our trumpet player out there, that Alan Bazzuti is going to be playing, a trumpet concerto by Tomasi. And so and Alan Bazzuti has agreed to play a little bit from our studio. It's kind of a gutsy thing for a solo trumpet player to do, but I think you're going to find out that that's going to work just fine. So let's go to our studio and get some sense of the artistic range of trumpet player Alan Bazzuti. Clearly the signature of a trumpet player getting to the end of his tune. Alan Bazzuti giving us several aspects of some pretty famous trumpet licks and things that a trumpet does when it's Alan Bazzuti playing it so beautifully. Alan, thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
And James.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, and supporting the symphony.
And so when you were a little kid playing the trumpet, what was the thing that was most fun once the trumpet, you and the trumpet found each other?
There were two things probably that pop into my mind. One was my dad was a self-taught trumpet player, mm-hmm. and he started me and mm-hmm. taught me all the way until I went to the Eastman School of Music. So connecting with your father in a way that's pretty unusual and mm-hmm. over a long period of time, and with very few bumps along the way, a couple, mm-hmm. but, teenagers. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And then the other thing that comes to mind was I was actually pretty small until, 16, 17 years old. I grew quite a few inches, which is really odd. Probably because in Montana, all we had to eat was dirt.
But, of course. Yeah.
So there's that. But anyway, the whole self-esteem and feeling like you're accomplishing something, that package, however best described, I'm not sure, but that was important as I look back. Gave me kind of a competitive, not competitive, but a standing with other people my age that was otherwise not there.
Yeah. And so about you, you know, that famous question of innate ability, of great teaching, of what makes a player. Did you early on find that you could do some things technically pretty adeptly, more than your peers?
That is an interesting question that we often ruminate and even joke about, the
sure.
chicken and the egg kind of,
thing.
Did the trumpet find me or did I find the trumpet? But I think, to be completely honest, along with quite a bit of consistent hard work, that I was well suited to the instrument, and that's just serendipity. Flexibility-wise and moving around on the instrument were things I could practice and get better at quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certain things that other players seem to struggle with, I don't find all that difficult. Trumpet is, thou art a fickle, you know what, though, because mm-hmm. the thing about it is tone production. From day to day, just playing a beautiful note, a single note, is challenging. Mm-hmm. And comes and goes in terms of its ease. So I get in the weeds a little bit, but yeah.
Sure. Well, hanging just a little longer with that question, now that you've written method books, you've taught things like that, some of the extraordinary things, and let's face it, there are unusual and extraordinary things technically that you can do on the trumpet, do they transfer to other people or just are they kind of within you?
Yes. My method book, the biggest one that's pretty well studied around the world, there were things I put in there that had not been notated at all before on the technical side of things. And now I walk down the hallways of a music school and I hear those things coming out of practice rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now, I would like to throw in there, though, my whole concept, well, there's a story with this, too, but my whole concept has to do with using those things for excitement, these technical things for excitement and interest, but also it has to be in a really musical foundation. Otherwise, it's kind of athletic, and a lot of it is nonsense otherwise, I think.
Sure, yeah. Well, no, that's always important. That's why I don't even want to dwell on it longer than we need to.
Well, that's okay, but one gets labeled a little bit, you know?
Yeah. And that's not why
you're... Could be worse labels, I suppose.
Why you're here, because of some of those
things. My picture's not up in too many post offices or anything.
There you go. And so as a kid, you grew up in Missoula. Did you have any, in addition to your dad, who was such a formative person for you, did the civilization of Missoula and music in Montana and things like that help you along too?
Well, yes. I'm talking about a period from, you know, beginning to through high school. Mm-hmm. So, yes, definitely. I had a couple really important band directors who were very in cahoots with my dad, who owned a music store, in terms of, you know, not me, just me, but music students, getting them to other places in the summers and taking some trips and having exposure. My very first performance in Seattle, where I live now, was at the old Opera House for a National Music Educators National Convention, soloing on La Virgen de la Macarena with the band.
In 1968.
Bullseye, way to go.
Yeah. That's because the Eastman Wind Ensemble played the same convention.
Oh, my gosh, and you were there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. But, yes, there were some very important music educators along the way. And we found, Laura is my wife, a pianist, and we found with our three children who are all in their 20s or a little bit above now, that music educators along the way have been prime influences, even though only one of our three is involved in music as a profession. Incredible psychology and help and ethics and safe places, like the band room is always a safe place.
That's huge.
Yeah. Whether you're a 6-7 foot athlete or a little wimpy kid who plays really an instrument, you know, it's such an amazing thing. So, you know, I'm big time into promoting music education. In fact, we'll be doing an educational presentation on Saturday. Yeah, tomorrow.
Yeah.
And master class.
And masterclass.
And masterclass tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
today?
Great. The usual.
The masterclass is today.
Masterclass is today. I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't look at the itinerary.
3 o'clock? 3 o'clock at the Fox.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. That's there. Yeah, well, certainly for my own kids, the tribe. Every kid needs a tribe. And boy, the music tribes are really great tribes.
Yeah. It's wonderful. And these people work really hard.
Yeah.
long hours, low pay kind of thing.
Sure.
A lot of them.
So that's, you just play the trumpet and you're known as a trumpet player, but you're also a composer. How did that creative thing move along with you, with the development of your instrumental ability?
I was noodling around when I was in high school with composition ideas, and nothing too deep. But when I got to Eastman School of Music, I had the opportunity, along with other students, to write music. And I went through the jazz and contemporary media part of the school as far as writing is concerned. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't really – one of the good things for me I wasn't forced, in quotations, or encouraged to write a lot of somebody else's style, Bach style, Mozart mm-hmm. style, to learn those things, which, of course, there's huge value there. To study geniuses, but I was in a situation where I could write any kind of music, and after the first year for orchestra even, and it would get performed and taped and performed in concert if it was up to par, which a lot mm-hmm. of it was, and then we would have recording sessions on weekends and do these things, and so I caught fire with that. That was back before the personal computer, so we were doing all by hand, big ink scores and, you know, copying parts and learning about, oops, we can't do this on a part because it ruins the whole performance or something like that, you know, in terms of notation. So the nuts and bolts of that came out of there. And then in my heart, I really enjoy composition and will do that as long as I'm able. And so I've had some commissions along the way, and I just keep cranking out things I want to do, not just trumpet music, but a big portion of it, yeah.
So when you play something like the Tomasi Concerto, as opposed to some other trumpet player playing it, how much is your composer part of you influencing you as you're making that music at that moment?
I would say not a lot. More interpretation, yes, as a personal interpretation of what's on the page. Really trying to represent what I imagine the composer would have liked.
Mm-hmm.
And then any little thing that I might do that is a bit unique will be fairly subtle. Trumpet players may notice, and a person who hasn't heard the concerto and might hear it again a year later might not notice, but we're always going for the battle between trumpet as close to perfection as we can get and then musical interpretation.
Sure. I guess where I was really going is that, do you feel that you can get inside Tomasi's head and understand why he wrote it in a certain way that maybe a non-composer could? Have you ever thought about that?
I have, yes. And I do think that would influence the way you would play it, but it's sort of kind of a general overview and feeling more than my words, current words can describe, really.
Yeah. But and you're kind of nodding to that too, James, about this thing. Because I don't know, when I've heard, you know, like Benjamin Britten as pianist, and Gunther Schiller was this way too, that it felt like... When they could really understand the music from a unique point of view because they're composers.
Yeah, I think there's a certain thing about, you know, when you're studying a piece of music, certainly as a conductor, there's a bit of kind of reverse engineering that you have to do, is you kind of figure out, okay, why did they do this and how did they come to these conclusions and what's important and what's not so important. And of course, Schuller wrote a book about conducting, The Complete Conductor, which is terrifying for any conductor because he goes through in pinpoint detail every part. You people, you don't understand this, and you get this wrong, and you get this wrong. Yes, he wrote about Daphnis and Chloe's second suite, so I've been kind of looking at that and thinking, But it's I think for me as a conductor, though, probably, and I did composing when I was younger, but more than that, orchestrating is the trick.
Bullseye.
That's the thing. You know, if you learn really well how to orchestrate yourself, then you can really understand so much about the mechanics of the orchestra.
Yeah. I think orchestrators in the movies and things like that are unsung heroes. And then composers who do write some beautiful things but have their music orchestrated by someone else, I think orchestration's half the composition myself.
Totally agree. Absolutely.
For your audience listening today, imagine a single loud note in a certain middle register played by a tuba or a piccolo.
Right.
In the same note, same register, it's possible. Well, maybe piccolo's a little too high, but say flute. You have a completely different mood, texture, feeling, everything.
Yeah, yeah, it's essential. Now, also, you're as all the things you've done, because a lot of your composing has been for a purpose. The overture that we heard before, the 10 o'clock hour, was written for a specific show. Mm-hmm. Show, I think. How have you and Jeff Tysik and various people worked to influence the direction of music and people's perception of music and the audiences that come to music and the connection between classical and pop,
right,
and all of those questions?
It's kind of sad because jazz, for instance, as a word, and classical as a word, are so general,
mm-hmm,
and hard to understand in terms of if you're not in music. But I think I can answer for me and myself and Jeff Tysik, who is my best friend, actually, and we spend a lot of time musically and as partners and families together, in that one of our goals was to, speaking to Pops concerts, for instance, was to have very high-quality music that was interesting for the orchestra to play, not just a throwaway. In other words, they come in and their eyes roll like, oh, I should have looked at this. Beautiful orchestrations and something, a lot for the audience to relate to. Whether before there were huge licensing issues, particularly it was much easier to do arrangements too, mm-hmm, of famous melodies. Now that's an obvious example. In the classical side of thing, and Jeff also is writing some amazing classical music of his own, that is influenced a little way by certain composers, but really has a Tysik voice, and I feel like I'm trying and hoping to do that too, that I like music that can be fairly contemporary and interesting in that, or even innovative in a sense. Adventuresome might be a better word, mm-hmm, but the audience, there's something they can hang their hat on, whether it's melodic colors, orchestrations, things that they will leave going like, wow, that was fun to listen to, instead of just angry and dissonant, you know. Now, there are reasons to write music like that at times, but consistently angry, dissonant, and music that has what I call very little melody, or maybe none, I don't get that. Yeah. Maybe I'm just curmudgeon. And I had to look that word up.
It's a good word, yeah. And you've chosen to live in Seattle,
right,
as opposed to New York or something like that. Quality of life, other musicians to play with.
Well, Laura and I both lived in L.A. quite a while.
Uh-huh.
And after being on the road with Woody Herman and then Chick Corea, I decided to move to L.A. because I knew the most people. And I was very busy with the movies and that whole scene down there, which is more of a craft than an art, and a wonderful craft. It's really, mm-hmm, interesting. Still pursuing solo activity and composition, I decided to move out of there. And by that time, my wife and I were reconnecting after years of separation. We both went to school together. Anyway, but when I say separation, is we were just friends.
Mm-hmm.
None of that other stuff. And I never personally had a desire to live in New York. I think I'm kind of lazy in that term, like dealing with it. It's so fun to visit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Many people feel that way. And when family came and I was still wanting to pursue soloistic career and things like that, we just started looking up and down the West Coast and making sure we knew the cities pretty well and all that, and chose Seattle for personal reasons, but also lifestyle, good schools, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's got a great airport. And if you think about it, if you don't travel much from Seattle, you can be in Asia,
mm-hmm,
in 9.5 to 10.5 hours flight. You can be in Europe in 9.5 to 10 hours flight. You can be lost in Africa somewhere. I don't know. I've never been there.
And so a lot of great places to be. Alan Vizzuti, who's here to play the Tomasi Concerto with the Spokane Symphony, and then if they clap hard enough, you'll come up with an encore for them. I presume.
I'll beg them.
Yeah.
Going to get it anyway.
There you go.
I'm so delighted to be here, and mm-hmm, not only at the radio station, but at the public radio station, but playing again with this wonderful orchestra in the Great Hall. And it's nice to be back.
Yeah, it feels, it's a great relationship. So thanks for